The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I am your host, Soraya, and tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we have as our guest Mac Maloney, author of a couple books on UFOs, UFOs in Wartime, and his latest, Beyond Area 51. How you doing, Mac?
I'm doing great tonight. Thanks for having me on.
And you said you've also written a bunch of novels prior to these two books on UFOs.
That's right. I've spent the past 20 years writing military adventure novels, and I just happened to have a chance a few years ago to write a nonfiction book called UFOs in Wartime, which is about UFOs in wartime. So that came out about just about 2 years ago, and this book, Beyond Area 51, is the follow-up to that.
And so the first book, I would assume, covers things like Foo Fighters and the like.
Right. We just it came about because I was having lunch with my editor one day, and for some reason the topic of UFOs came up. I've always been a big, I guess a fan of UFOs, or even when I was a kid, I was just fascinated with UFOs. And for some reason, it seemed to me that UFOs were seen more, reported more in wartime. And as you say, certainly with the Foo Fighters in World War II, and I know that there were a lot of UFO sightings in Vietnam. So I mentioned this to the editor, and he says, maybe we could, do a book on that, a nonfiction book. So I did some research and pitched them the book, and they said, yeah, let's do it. So we wound up doing it, and we try to at least give the argument that UFOs do show up more in times of war than in peacetime, and we really don't know why. I thought at first maybe because especially in the 20th century, where airplanes were flying around, maybe more people looking up at the sky or whatever, but it really kind of goes beyond that. We don't offer any explanation why this is, but I think we make a pretty good case that more UFOs are seen during wartime than during peacetime.
And that's fascinating. It's also interesting that they tend to kind of gravitate toward, like, nuclear bases and stuff.
That's a big part of UFOs in wartime because you're right. Ever since there has been nuclear power, and places where, not just nuclear power plants, but missile bases, the place where they refine uranium to make weapons-grade plutonium, things of that nature. For some reason, these places are have frequent visits from UFOs and have been for over the decades. And this is something that the U.S. government is aware of. There's been a lot of documentation on things of that nature, a lot of witnesses. Of course, the military really doesn't have any comment on it, but the facts are that these things happen a lot over anything having to do with nuclear or nuclear power, nuclear weapons.
And there have been incidents where they've, like, turned on nuclear silos and stuff, or turned them off during tests, haven't there?
Right, yep. There's just dozens of documented cases where UFOs will show up over missile silos. A lot of these ICBM bases that used to be in the middle of the country are now gone because of our various treaties with the Soviet Union. But back when they were all full of nuclear missiles, there were many cases where UFOs would show up over these silos and shut everything down inside the missile silos themselves. On some occasions, they actually retargeted the warheads of some of these missiles. Lots of witnesses saw these things, exactly what it means, obviously we don't know, but it happened a lot in the 60s and the 70s, certainly.
And it's such an odd thing. I mean, and any UFO explanation would have to take that into account, and it just makes it that much more difficult to come up with a solid, any kind of solid explanation as to what these things may be.
Right. I mean, I agree. It really is something that, someday when the scientific community finally starts looking into UFOs, I think you start looking at, exactly why these things show up over these facilities that we're talking about. It seems like it's almost like they're you know, they are giving us some kind of sign, some kind of warning, you know, that we can shut these things off if we want to. My opinion is, over the course of writing these books, I think there's a good chance that UFOs are actually time travelers from our own future.
And it's something I always consider.
Yeah, there's as much evidence, or there's enough. I don't want to say as much evidence, because there really isn't any evidence that UFOs are, you know, from outer space. But it's as good an explanation as any, especially when you look at it from the point of view of what we talk about in UFOs in wartime, especially with the Foo Fighters. There were just dozens, hundreds of instances mm-hmm. where these UFOs would fly alongside, bombers that are on bombing missions over Germany in the middle of the night, and you know, not doing anything other than just kind of flying parallel to these bomber formations, almost as if they're observing what's going on. And then when you kind of take that idea and apply it to things that happened during World War One, things that happened in Vietnam, certainly in Korea, it just seems like they're observing us. And so this idea just came, hey, you know, maybe they're just time tourists, you know, maybe they're historians from the future coming back to see how history was really made. I think it's as good as explanation as, you know, that they're little green men from Mars.
I think it's probably a better explanation than they're little green men from Mars. But yeah, it's something I always consider for the very same reason, that it seems like they're observing us in certain particular historic moments.
Right. Yep. It sure does. And once again, that's why I, you know, advocate, you know, anytime that I can, that the only way that we're going to find out what UFOs are is by somehow making the climate of scientific investigation into UFOs, making it more palatable for scientists to do this. As we all know now, you know, any scientist who, you know, says I'm going to look into UFOs is, labeled kind of a flake or, you know, a kook in the scientific community, which is actually a very kind of conservative establishment. And we have to kind of get away from that. You know, we have to allow scientists, or somehow the people who fund scientific exploration, scientific endeavors, to take that kind of stigma off of looking into UFOs. And I think when that happens, one of the first things they should look at is, why do these things show up at these kind of historic events?
Yeah. And the thing is, you can definitely say something is happening. You can't say what it is, because we simply don't have the evidence to support one theory over another.
Right.
But you can definitely say something is happening. These things have been witnessed by enough people, have been caught on radar and video and so many other things. It, even when you throw out the obvious hoaxes, and there's just too much there to say nothing's going on.
Right. I mean, you're exactly right. And what happened in Korea, for instance, is very interesting, because where there was a lot of Foo Fighters spotted in World War II, when we were fighting in Korea, which was really only about 5 years later, you had not only radar on the ground. I mean, in World War II, you had some radar, but it wasn't as widespread as it was 5 years later in Korea. And now you had radar on ships on the ground, but you also had radar in almost every airplane that was up there flying around. So when these pilots would see UFOs, not only would they see them visually, but they would see them on their aircraft's radar. When UFOs would fly over an aircraft carrier, for instance, which they did quite often during the Korean War, they would be picked up on radar on the aircraft carrier, because aircraft carriers are always accompanied by a number of ships. You'd have, you know, six or seven ships or more acquiring these UFOs electronically. Where everyone had radar, that just, you know, increase the amount of evidence that something was up there, that it wasn't an optical illusion. Something was up there returning a radar signal. And Korea is actually a turning point in how the military looked at UFOs. They knew that after so many UFOs were spotted in the late 40s and the early 50s, both in the United States, but particularly during the Korean conflict, they knew something was up, and that really was the beginning of Project Blue Book that the Air Force started in the early 50s. Not that they did any great shakes, you know, not that they did any great investigations, but at least at that point, the Air Force felt they had to do something. And a lot of what happened during the Korean War was really the reason that the Air Force started something like that, Project Blue Book.
And if I remember right, I believe like Jacques Vallée felt that they probably had another investigative branch that they knew nothing about that was actually secret investigating these things, and Blue Book was just kind of the public cover.
Well, you know, that's one of those things. It would be great if that was true in a way, because that means that there might be, you know, files and files, you know, banks of files somewhere, you know, hidden in the Pentagon, which would have a lot of information that would be very useful to UFO researchers. But again, it's one of those things that, you know, who knows if it's true or not. I'm one of these people. I don't believe that the U.S. military knows any more about UFOs or the origin or what UFOs are. I don't think they know any more than you or I do.
And I would agree.
I think they have more evidence, like they have more, you know, film evidence, photographic evidence, and things of that nature. But I do not believe that they know any more about the origins of UFOs than you know, the man on the street. And there's a lot of people, you know, who want to turn this into this kind of, you know, government conspiracy thing and so on. And, you know, you know, who knows? I'm just, you know, this is just one opinion. But I don't see any evidence of the U.S. military, you know, being in league with gray aliens. You know, you hear really some crazy stuff, you know, that we, you know, have a secret space force and, you know, we're partnered up with the gray aliens and things of that nature. I love science fiction and it makes good science fiction, but I just don't believe it happens in reality.
Yeah, and I'm on the same page with you on there. And you called the new book Beyond Area 51, and I was half expecting something that was, or I would have been expecting, if I hadn't heard you on the Grailian Report, I would have been expecting this to be something that promotes the idea that we're in league with gray aliens and so on and so forth. But instead, you have taken a very fact-based look at what people have cited around these different secret locations around the world and stuff. I mean, you stick to the facts, basically. You don't do a lot of idle speculation about, you know, things that can't be confirmed, and it's a very impressive book, honestly.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and it's really the only way I could do it, you know. I know that there are a number of, you know, I mean, let's face it, there are lots of books out there that are just filled with stuff that, you know, can't even come close to being verified. You know, what is supposedly happening at Dulce Mountain and things of that nature. You know, or that the Nazis had, you know, UFOs and were in contact with aliens during World War II and have a, you know, a base on the moon and all that. Once again, I love science fiction. I think that those ideas are cool as science fiction, but you know they're not true. And you know, I suppose I could have written a book, you know, just filled with speculation. But you know, I just think it's doing a disservice to the reader. It would actually be doing a disservice to my publisher. And you know, why not go with the facts? I think the facts themselves are intriguing and fascinating. So, you know, why muck it up with a lot of stuff that, you know, a lot of it is just pure nonsense, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. And you have, I believe it was the Dulce base that you start the chapter by basically collecting stories off the internet.
Right. A lot of people I found out later on actually stopped reading the book at that point and would give and gave me bad reviews on Amazon. And I had to write to some of them personally and say, just go on beyond page 63, because if you go on the internet and you read these stories about what's happening there, that there are 50,000 aliens living inside this mountain, and there's this, you know, just awful kind of nightmarish laboratory where they, you know, make these beings half fish, half octopus, half men, half this, half that, and that there's been these battles there with, you know, SEAL Team 6 and all this stuff. And you know, so we, and you know, I begin the chapter like that, and I go for three or four pages until I think at one point you just go, you know, okay, let's stop the nonsense. I think the nonsense stops when it turns out that if you eat Hershey bars, the aliens inside of Dulce Mountain will leave you alone, you know? And then you really get into what happened there, you know, and it's a fascinating story how the government took this one UFO researcher and really drove him crazy for reasons that, you know, I'll leave open and people can buy the book and find out. It's actually the story about how the government, you know, destroyed a human being. And once again, I think that's an even more fascinating story than, you know, people believing there's 50,000 aliens inside this mountain in New Mexico.
And that was Benowitz, wasn't it?
Right, yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, Dr. Benowitz. And I mean, the short version of the story is that he was someone who he was very close to Kirkland Air Force Base in New Mexico. He was a physicist. He had his own little business. And he started picking up what he believed were signals from UFOs that were flying over a part of the base that where nuclear bombs, where nuclear weapons were in storage. And this is going back 30 years or so. And he also thought he was seeing UFOs over certain parts of the base. So he got in touch with the base, and they actually gave him, had him come in and tell them what he was seeing. And they led him to believe that, yes, that, you know, this is exactly what was going on. They tied this into cow mutilations and so on and so forth. But what he actually found out was two separate things. He was detecting signals that were actually used as a part of the security apparatus to keep these nuclear weapons that were in storage there away from the prying eyes of Russian satellites. And when he saw these UFOs, what he thought UFOs were probably early test flights of stealth prototype aircraft. He put these two things together, and it just clicked in his head that these UFOs are UFOs. The military, it was just two separate top-secret programs, so they figure, well, instead of telling this guy the truth, we'll let him kind of go off in his own delusioned way, and we'll feed him a lot of false information about UFOs to kind of get everyone off the track. And the thing is that he believed them to the point where he was institutionalized a couple times, and even after... he was told by the people who in the military who actually cooked up the scheme that they had been feeding him misinformation all along. He was at a point where mentally he still couldn't believe it, and he died a broken man. And basically our government did that to this guy who was really, at the end of the day, was just trying to be sincere and try to, you know, kind of look after our own national security, let's say, when it came to, you know, whatever was flying around up there, whether it was, you know, Russian satellites or UFOs. And it's really a very sad story.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll be honest, it did throw me when I got to that chapter and you started, you know, relating all the crazy stories. I'm like, wait, what just happened? Mm-hmm. And then I realized, Wade, he's got to justify this in a minute.
Well, yeah, that's what happened. I mean, you know, it's funny because it's... when you get to that chapter, I mean, we've already done, I think, three or four chapters, and you just have to think of a new way to start off a chapter instead of just saying, you know, in Mexico. So, you know, I just went online one day and just found all these just crazy stories having to do with this particular incident with Benowitz. And I said, you know, let's just put all the craziest ones together. And I mean, they are crazy. And when you read them, they just get more absurd as you go along. And then we tell the real story, which is, you know, is validated and just a very sad story and completely, you know, to left field of what a lot of people believe is actually happening out there.
And it's not just that the stories are crazy; they're completely unsubstantiated. There's no evidence to back any of it up, but yet people believe it.
Yeah, I know. And people go around, you know, there are, you know, quote-unquote researchers, UFO researchers, who go around giving lectures and writing books and, you know, basically making money off of telling these stories that are completely unsubstantiated. But you see, it goes back to the whole thing of what goes, what happens within the UFO community itself. And what it is, to me, is that people want to believe in UFOs. Therefore, a lot of people will believe anything they hear about UFOs. You know, the way I look at it is you have to take away 90% of that stuff because it's nonsense, you know.
Yeah.
Concentrate on that 10% that, you know, that isn't nonsense. And what's interesting, too, is I think that the ratio is the same to the number of UFO sightings. You know, the rule of thumb is there's 1,000 UFO sightings made around the world every month. 90% of them can be explained away as airplanes, birds, whatever. It's 10% that can't be explained. It's almost like the same ratio is that you, when you take the whole wealth of quote-unquote knowledge within the UFO community that's accumulated over the decades, I think you can lop off 90% of that as just nonsense. Concentrate on that 10%, and it will get us all closer to finding out what is really going on with this UFO puzzle.
And I think when it comes to UFO sightings nowadays, part of the problem is there are so many secret researches and planes and stuff like that that we don't know anything about. And who knows what they actually have, what kind of technology they actually have. So it's so hard to separate what's a genuine UFO versus what's a military craft that's just not known yet.
Right. And we know, too, that one of the things the government does do is that they use the public as kind of guinea pigs when they're testing some kind of a new aircraft. Like, for instance, there was a very strange airplane spotted over Texas a couple weeks ago. It looks like nothing more than a flying triangle, but it was flying right. very fast. And at a certain altitude, people got photographs of it. And we know that in the past, the military has purposely flown its secret airplanes over populated areas to see if, you know, and then they will count how many UFO reports or how many people actually see this thing, you know, let's say the next day. So they know that their secret plane can be seen from, you know, ground level, let's say at 15,000 feet, because we flew it at 15,000 feet and people reported UFOs. But if we fly it at 20,000 feet and there are no UFO reports, then they know they can fly it at 20,000 feet and, you know, be more or less safe in the fact that it can't be seen from the ground. That's a simplistic way of looking at it, but we know that they have done that in the past. And they probably still do it. And they probably still do it with, you know, drone activity too. Once again, that doesn't mean that they know what UFOs are. It's a great leap from point A to point B on that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And it's within the realm of what we can do with technology. I mean, you got to figure they're probably about 20 years ahead of what we actually know that they can do.
Yes, for sure. And another thing, too, is that, and I know this only because I've written so many of these military fiction books, is that, you know, for every stealth fighter that actually goes to the production line, for every stealth bomber that is actually built, there is probably anywhere from 6 or 7 to 8 or 9 prototypes of airplanes that don't work, that fail. And, you know, but people see those things flying around up there, too. You never get to see them again. Like a lot of people would see, you know, years ago, would see the B-2 bomber, the B-2 stealth bomber flying overhead. And if you didn't know what that thing was, I saw one fly over once. And if you didn't know what that was, the first thing you would think is this thing is from outer space because it's just so strange looking.
Right.
Well, you know, who knows what other strange looking things people have seen. But have never seen the light of day as far as the military is concerned, because, you know, these things never went into production. So that really does account, I believe, for lots of UFO sightings, especially down in the Southwest, you know, down in Nevada and out west, Nevada, California, where a lot of this activity is going on.
Okay, let's one of the things you talk about in here is I think very relevant to the whole subject, and that's the story of Ong's hat.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell people a little bit about that?
Well, you know, we put that in for a reason, and I found out about Ong's hat in a very unusual way. I know these people in the music business who are friends of mine, and from the group called the Moody Blues from years ago. Mm-hmm. And one of them was on his way to be interviewed at a radio station that is a Philadelphia radio station, but is actually the transmitter is in New Jersey. And they had to go through the Pine Barrens in New Jersey to get to this radio station. And he told me that this was like the strangest place he had ever driven through. And it, you know, there were UFO. He said he saw UFOs and, you know, strange people on the roadside. And I said, what is this? You know, and I live up in Boston. I've driven through New Jersey. I didn't know what the Pine Barrens were. But it's this very strange place in the middle of New Jersey. It takes up a good part of New Jersey,
yeah,
which is just kind of, you know, woods, thick woods, swamps, things like that. The soil there cannot support, like, crops and stuff. So it was never settled back when America was settled a few hundred years ago. There were a couple villages there, and I just kind of looked into it, and I came upon the story of Ong's Hat. So anyway, Ong's Hat is this very small village in the middle of the Pine Barrens in New Jersey that is abandoned now, but it was an actual place. And the story that we came upon is that these twins, a boy and a girl, who went to Princeton. They were very intelligent people. Went to Princeton for physics and astrophysics. Their father raised them on a UFO commune down in Texas, and they came up with these theories where that said that it was actually relatively easy to go from one dimension to another, and it really had more to do with thought processes than actually building something that would transport you there. And they came up with these ideas as a scientific theory. Well, they brought them to Princeton. They had done their doctorate on it, and the people at Princeton Review Board, you know, looked at it and not only didn't give them their doctorates, but they got thrown out of Princeton. So they went to Ong's Hat in a trailer, and they continued their work, and they worked with some other, let's say, underground scientists, and they actually found a way to go to another dimension. And they wrote about it, and word got around and so on. And then at some point, Delta Force helicoptered into their place, and depending on what version you want to hear or want to believe, they either killed them all or they escaped into another dimension, but their little laboratory was destroyed by the government for reasons unknown. So that's the story. But when you actually look deeper into it, what the story of Ong's Hat actually is that there were people back in the, like, in the late 70s, I mean, when the internet, in the early 80s, when the internet was just literally in its infancy, when things are actually in the middle days, when things were just like a lot of bulletin boards and stuff like that, these people got together and they decided to create the first internet myth, the first myth that would actually go out into the internet, just like the first myth was at some point way, way long time ago, told around a campfire or something. They wanted to create the first internet myth. And this is the myth that they created, that this thing, these people were doing these scientific experiments in Ong's Hat. And it got to the point where it did go around the internet in such a way that people started adding their own kind of, quote-unquote, evidence to it. And it became this kind of almost elaborate game of kids call telephone, where you tell, you know, you were at one side of the room and you tell one something and it goes around to people, and by the time it gets to the other side of the room, it's almost it's almost indistinguishable from, you know, what was first said.
Right.
So we put that in there because that's, you know, really in a way, that's how people look at UFOs. They look at these stories about, you know, UFOs having connections to these secret military bases and so on, is that it just keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And we ask the question at the end of the book, is that really what the whole UFO phenomena is? Is that it just started from one little point, and now all of us have just been adding to it, adding to it. And when you really look at it, maybe there's nothing there. But as it turns out, we kind of refute that, because there is things there. There is something there, because we know, for instance, airline pilots see UFOs all the time. Military pilots see UFOs all the time. As we were talking about earlier, they're picked up on radar all the time. Lots of people saw them during World War II, during Korea, in Vietnam especially. People saw them over Iraq, Afghanistan. They're still seeing them today. You know, there is something there. And I'll go back to my earlier statement but the way you figure it out is not by telling stuff that is unsubstantiated. The way you figure it out is you look at what can be substantiated and concentrate on that. That's the only way we're going to figure out what these things are. And the story of Ong's Hat kind of brings that all together, you know, at the beginning of the book and then again at the end.
It does, absolutely. It's something I hadn't heard of before, and it was and it really does show you how that myth can turn in can be diluted, or people can dilute a myth into thinking that it's something true.
Right, exactly.
Especially when you keep looking it up and you can find a trail back, but if you don't go back far enough, you don't realize it was literally intentionally invented.
Right, right. That's the interesting thing about it.
Now, you want to talk a little bit about Bob Lazar? I mean, he's been a big name in the UFO field for a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And you want to talk about how he figures in a little and what you think of him?
Well, Bob Lazar was someone who, back in the late 80s, was initially interviewed by a TV station in Las Vegas. And he claimed that he worked at Area 51 and also this satellite facility called S4 that was about 20 miles southwest of Area 51 at a place called Papoose Lake. A dry lake, and very close to this place called Papoose Mountain. And what he said was, inside this mountain, the U.S. military had a number of crashed flying saucers, vehicles, aircraft that they had recovered from various crash sites around the world or around the United States, including the Roswell crash site. He said that he worked, physically worked on these UFOs, that he saw them fly, and that the U.S. military, you know, was in effect keeping what would be one of the greatest revelations of in human history from the rest of us. So he went on this kind of media tour and did a lot more interviews. And it was really because of him that Area 51 became well known. In fact, as we say in the book, and we're not the first people to say it, but Area 51 is the best known top secret base in the world.
Yeah.
So he was in the public eye for quite a while, gave a lot of speeches, a lot of interviews and things of that nature. And then he kind of disappeared. He's still out there, but he kind of disappeared. And people, you know, questioned, well, is what he is saying true? And some of the things that he said, you know, turned out to be fact. But other things he said were not facts. You know, he kind of maybe exaggerated his educational background, exaggerated exactly how much work and how much he was being paid for it by the government, and so on. And there is one version in there that we have where it turns out that one of the reasons he went public with this is that he was actually missing, you know, he was missing a lot of time that he should have been spending with his wife. Where he would be gone for 3 or 4 days at a time, supposedly working at S4, and he couldn't tell her where he was. There's stories that he used to bring her out to a certain part of an area in the desert, very close to the border of Area 51, and at 9 o'clock they would see some kind of very strange UFO-like thing fly over their head, and so on. And so he became this kind of notorious figure, and a lot of people believe verbatim what he said. And we kind of go over that. And some of it is like really crazy. Some of it is that, you know, that inside this Papoose Mountain, you know, there was these secret hit teams that were set up by Dick Cheney and, you know, right, to kill Americans. And, you know, and once again, we're in this kind of realm of science fiction. But one theory that we came upon was that there's a possibility that Bob Lazar was actually a disinformation agent for the U.S. government. And this is a reason, and for some reason, this kind of makes sense to me. Russian satellites at the time Soviet satellites, would go over Area 51 on an almost daily basis. And Area 51, what we know they really do is test our top secret aircraft. It's one of the places out west that tests top secret aircraft away from the public's eyes. And they would have these aircraft out on the runway, testing them and so on, but every time a satellite would go over, they would have to move these things into the hangar so the Russian satellites wouldn't be able to take pictures of them. And then when they developed infrared technology, what would happen is, you know, you might have an airplane out in the runway and with its engines going, but even though you moved it into the hangar so it wouldn't get photographed, it would leave a heat signature on the runway that looked was almost as good as a photograph. So what you had at Area 51 was these people moving these aircraft back and forth on a daily basis. And, you know, let's face it, that's a lot of schlepping to do when you're supposed to be doing other things. Right. So this theory goes is that Bob Lazar went out there, gave all this information on this place that was to the south of Area 51, supposed this S-4. And I guess later on they did prove that it diverted a number of the Russian satellites from going over Area 51 to going over this area S-4, and just made the work of the people at Area 51, you know, a little less strenuous physically. You know, to me, that's as good an explanation as any. In fact, that sounds, that does have the makings of some kind of a U.S. government or, let's say, intelligence agencies kind of disinformation campaign, kind of deflection type thing. So exactly what Bob was up to, no one really knows. I know that he runs a small business now, I think, somewhere in the Midwest, where he still does business with the U.S. Defense Department, so they can't be that mad at him. Someday he should sit down with someone who is a really qualified journalist or UFO writer and tell us all exactly what he was up to.
And the interesting thing about that, too, is that you would think if he was actually giving out top secret information, he would be stopped.
Exactly. Stopped or you know, arrested or paid off or
shot.
You know, or shot. Well, I don't know if the, you know, I don't know if the U.S. government actually would shoot someone of that nature. I'm not someone who is a big proponent of a lot of the things that the U.S. government does, the military does, and so on. But I really think they would, and maybe I'm being naive, but I really think that they would draw the line on, I don't think they would actually shoot someone that was giving information having to do with, like you're right, exactly. He wouldn't have got as far as he did unless they were, you know, kind of a wink and a nod.
Right. Yeah, no matter how they were going to get rid of him, they would have done something.
Right, yeah. I mean, they would have given him, you know, $50 million or something, you know.
Yeah, well, and nowadays they just throw him in Guantanamo.
Yeah, or something along those lines. See, but when you do something like that, they would have to, someday he would get out, you know. That's why I think it would be more likely that they would pay him off.
Okay. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mac Maloney.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we are talking to Mac Maloney tonight on Where Did the Road Go. His new book is called Beyond Area 51. It's a very good book, a very interesting read. And the fact that you have also written novels explains to me why this was so easy to read and felt like more of a, like, even though it's not a story, it had that feel to it, like you were reading a story rather than a dry, fact-based book, even though it is a fact-based book.
Right. I mean, that's really the only way I know how to write, if I can put it that way. And I just think it's more interesting if, when you do it like that. There's a lot of, you know, UFO books out there that, you know, even though the subject matter might be interesting, they're kind of dry or whatever. But the idea was that, you know, we would kind of just take you on this trip around the world to all these secret bases, not just in the U.S., but also in Britain and Russia, Australia, China, and tell you about exactly what we know is going on at these places, you know, which has been documented, what they do, but also every single one of them, except one, has a history of UFO activity around them. And once again, we ask the question, we don't answer the question, but we pose the question, you know, why do these secret bases always have UFO history to them? And it's not just UFOs are seen over these things. Once again, it got to, you know, where UFOs would be around and whatever they were doing at these secret bases would be shut down and lose all electrical power and things of that nature. But all except for HOP, the facility up in Alaska, which a lot of people suspect is actually causing all this, you know, crazy weather and climate change that we've been having recently. All of these secret bases have... and one also, I have to amend that. there's a place in about 100 miles north of Area 51 that very few people have heard of. It's called the Tonopah Test Range. It's near Tonopah, Nevada, out in the middle of nowhere. It's an air base. It's where the stealth fighters were tested for 10 years, and no one ever knew these things were flying around out there. They test the really, really hot stuff up in Tonopah. And that place has absolutely no UFO history. It's almost as if UFOs stay away from the place, which I think is interesting in its own right.
Well, let me ask you this. Are these bases put on places that previously had UFO sites or sightings and stuff, or do the UFO sightings start once the bases are there?
Well, see, that's the question, you know, is, and we really don't know. We don't know. I mean, it seems more likely that the bases were built there and the UFOs showed up. That's certainly the case of these bases that we talk about in Australia. Down in the southwest part of Australia, there's a place called the Nullarbor Plain that has a highway that goes through it, through the Australian desert, and it's the straightest highway in the world. It goes for about 1,000 miles, and there's not a curve in it because there's no reason for it. And this highway has so many UFO sightings and so many kind of belligerent UFO sightings, UFOs forcing cars off the roads and stuff like that. There are actually signs there saying, you know, next 1,000 miles, beware of UFOs. And this place, as it turned out, never had any kind of UFO history, but it's where in the early 50s the British came to test their nuclear weapons. There's really no place in England to test nuclear weapons. So because Australia was actually part of the British Commonwealth, they brought their nuclear weapons testing facilities to Nullarbor Plain, started lighting off nuclear weapons. Actually, it was in an Aborigine holy land, this place. And as soon as they started doing that, just UFOs started showing up and doing things like shutting off the electricity, screwing up the radar, doing something that would prevent an atomic bomb test on a certain day, and scaring the hell out of people who were driving on this Nullarbor Plain. Highway. That's certainly a case where man went into some place and started, you know, fooling with Mother Nature, let's say, and the UFOs showed up right afterwards. On the other hand, we talk about a place called the St. Louis Valley in southwest Colorado, which is surrounded by military bases. Very strange place. People see UFOs there on a regular basis, but they also see ghosts, they see Bigfoot, they see flying humans. There's cat emulations. It's like a potpourri of paranormal activity happening in the St. Louis Valley. And while there are no military bases within the St. Louis Valley, it's ringed by military bases. So that almost seems like a place where, yes, they did know something was up, and they built military bases around it. So you can look at it either way. But once again, you know, we can't come up with any definitive answer because, you know, we just don't have the information or the intelligence to do so, but still poses a very interesting question. What came first, the chicken or the egg, right?
Yeah. And it makes me wonder, too, though, if they, I mean, because these areas like the San Luis Valley are referred to often as window areas and do have all that strange phenomena going on. Same with in England there, Rendlesham.
Right,
was
exactly.
Was also a window area, and they put a base right next to it. So maybe they know that these areas have something special to them and are hoping to build some research off of whatever it is that's there.
Well, and there's another place, too, that you know, I'm sure a lot of people in your audience have heard of it, is this place called AUTEC, which is the Navy's Area 51. And it's a place where they test nuclear submarines, where they test captains, people, you know, officers who have just been given command of a nuclear submarine. They test a lot of devices and technology that are built into nuclear submarines. And the strange thing about this place is that it's not even in the United States. It's in the Bahamas, and it is right smack dab in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. So for whatever reason, the Navy, and this is a fact, the Navy built its own version of Area 51 in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And they see UFOs, people report UFOs and USOs, unidentified submerged objects, down there all the time. And we go back 30, 40 years of people seeing strange activity down there. Now, the Navy denies all this, even though at this base, this AUTEC base, they have billions, literally billions of dollars worth of radar equipment and sonar equipment, radar equipment that can see some kind of aircrafts coming from 800 to 900 miles away, sonar equipment that can detect things underwater for, you know, hundreds of miles away. Yet the Navy says, you know, we don't know anything about this UFO activity, yet people, civilians, are seeing this stuff down there all the time. So it really begs the question, well, you know, are they lying to us about not knowing about all this UFO activity? Or is it that the billions of dollars of radar and sonar equipment doesn't work? Because it's one or the other. Because if the radar and the sonar equipment work, then they are picking up UFO activity that civilians are seeing with their eyes. So they knew, or they know certainly, that there's a lot of UFO activity down near their Area 51, but did they know it before they built the base there? Once again, who knows?
Yeah. Well, back to Australia. Australia has some of the weirdest UFO reports probably in this book. You already talked about the cars being forced off the highway and stuff. You have a couple detailed incidents in the book. But you also talk about a base where it seems to have interaction with UFOs.
Right. There's a place called Pine Gap in Australia, and it's easy to find because it is literally the geographic center of Australia. It is smack dab in the middle of Australia, out in the middle of the desert where very few people live, that very few people even travel to. What we know is that it's an NSA listening site. It's a huge facility run by the NSA and the CIA and the Australian military jointly. And it's one of these places where it is, you know, where the NSA can listen in on every phone call, every email, every Skype, you name it, in Asia. I mean, that's basically what they do. But there have been so many reports there of UFO activity, and not just UFOs flying overhead and so on, but there's been a lot of reports of people seeing UFOs landing there, UFOs flying in and out of these kind of tunnels they have in the mountains. We have a story in there that these hunters saw that looks like it's right out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the movie where a UFO comes down on this base and there seems to be some kind of communication going on between the people on the ground and whatever is inside the UFO. The strange thing is that these people reported this incident that is so much like Close Encounters. They reported it years before that movie ever came out. And then there were many other, you know, eyewitness accounts of what seems to be some kind of UFO activity that is in concert with what is happening at Pine Gap. Now, you know, who knows what's really going on there, because it's a very high security base. And maybe people are just seeing, as we were talking about before, seeing some kind of aircraft that the public eye has never seen before. You know, yeah. And there's a lot of people who, Bill Burns, you know, of UFO Hunters, and someone who I respect a lot as someone who is a rational voice in the UFO community. And he says, well, think about it. If you were really building a spy plane that you didn't want anyone to suspect, you would build it so it would look like a UFO, like a flying saucer. Yeah, so when it was seen, people would just say, oh, I saw a UFO, and it's automatically discounted. And people see UFOs all the time over China, over Russia. You know, they could very well be our own kind of spy craft. And maybe that's what people see flying around Pine Gap. But there's just so many instances of it. It was fascinating to write about the accounts because they were just so vivid and everything. And who knew all this was happening in the middle of Australia?
Right. And one of the weirdest things you have in this book revolves around, I think it's Oxai Chin.
Yes, that's right, in China. Just a very strange, another strange story. You know, one day a German researcher was looking at photographs on Google Earth, and he came upon this place in China where, actually in the middle of China, where the Chinese military had built a scale model of a place called Oxai Chin, which is actually much further to the west on the border of India and China in the Himalaya Mountains. And this incredibly detailed mock-up of this area the Chinese military had built this mock-up. It's exact to, I think, 1/20th scale, but no one knows why they did it, because it doesn't seem like you would build this for any kind of military maneuvers, because it's in the Himalayas, and it's not like you can, that jet aircraft are going to do you any good there, or that tanks or ground troops of any size or anything. No one knows exactly why the Chinese built this. But when you go and look at what has happened in Aksai-Chin over the years, in 1962, the Russians and in India fought a war. It happened during in Aksai-Chin, in the Himalayas. It happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, so it really didn't get a whole lot of play here in the United States or around the world, because everyone was worried about what was going to happen with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But they had this small little war over one of the most inhospitable places on Earth. I mean, they were battling up at the top of some of these peaks in the Himalayas. More soldiers on both sides died from the frozen conditions than died in actual combat. You know, why they had this war, no one really knows, but because it was always kind of unclear. Why would you go to war over this piece of land that is just this area of the Earth that is just, as I say, one of the most hospitable places on the planet? Well, some UFO researchers, you know, have gone there ever since, and they go and they talk to the very few people who live there. And if you talk to these people, they say, we see UFOs all the time. We see them coming out of these crevices between the mountains. There's documented evidence that people were seeing UFOs there hundreds of years ago. One researcher went to some kids in a village and asked them to, I was there one day in the school, in a school lesson where they were told, you know, draw something that you see every day. And like, you know, more than half the kids drew UFOs over their village and stuff like that. You know, there's like lots of UFO activity over this area that China and India fought a war over in 1962, and now the Chinese have made this incredibly detailed scale model of. And why they're doing it, no one has any idea, but it just seems like it would almost have to have something to do with this strange history of UFOs over that area. But once again, it's one of these head scratches that, you know, we don't provide the answer, but, you know, we provide the evidence, and it's just fun to speculate what could be the answer.
Yeah, and it's such a weird thing for them to do, because it couldn't have been a cheap endeavor.
Right. And then someone says, I think we actually have the a quote from someone saying, why would they go through the bother of building this scale model of basically a huge part of the Himalayan mountains, where you could probably have a computer simulation program that would cost you about $100 that would do the same thing?
Yeah.
Who knows, you know, and no one knows, and the Chinese certainly aren't talking, so maybe someday they will, but you know, that's kind of a fascinating story.
Yeah. Another fascinating one was, one of the things you talk about is the different areas in Britain that might be home to their sort of Area 51, and one of the ones you talk about is a phantom town.
Right, yeah, that's, you know, another strange thing. You know, when Google Earth, first came into being, for some reason, they came up with this phantom town in the middle of England. And it was on their maps. It had its own postal code. It had its own business listings, real estate listings, number of houses, people who lived there, what their median income was, how many cars are there, all this information on this place. But when people went to the coordinates, it wasn't there. and when they went to Google and asked, and they actually went to the company that supplies satellite photos and information to Google, Google Earth, they asked them, you know, what is going on here? The town vanished from Google Maps. And you know, once again, what is going on? You know, what is going on here? You know, we don't know, but we just thought it was an interesting story. And we put it in the chapter of this kind of search for Britain's Area 51. We kind of give a top 10 of where Britain's Area 51 might be. And you kind of search along with us until you get to what seems to be the most likely case. We know Britain does have an Area 51. We just don't know where, but we think we give a pretty good amount of information on where we think it might be. You know, a lot of stuff goes on in Britain. Britain is just a very strange place anyway. There's a lot of very odd things that go on in Britain having to do with lots of ghost stories, lots of stories of paranormal stories of, you know, huge creatures and monsters and swamps and lakes and hauntings and so on and so forth, and radios that broadcast, you know, speeches by Winston Churchill from, you know, back in World War II, and the radio isn't even plugged in, and really crazy stuff. And so, you know, the fact that, you know, you have to go looking for their Area 51, and one of the suspect locations is right near Stonehenge, and wow, you know, just Britain is a very, very strange, strange place.
Oh, absolutely. There was also, right next to Britain, you talk about the Gorebridge area in Scotland, and how that's almost another window area of weirdness.
It's, well, you know, I didn't realize this, but if you put the numbers together, it turns out more people in Scotland see UFOs than any other country in the world. And they, in the place in Scotland where they see them, is this place called the Falkirk Triangle, and where people see, within this triangle, where people see more UFOs than any place else within the triangle, is this place called Bonnybridge, where they're just seen all the time. I mean, this is from the British military reports on UFOs, which the British government released a few years ago. And what is, I thought, fascinating about it is that right close to this place called Bonnybridge is a place called Roslyn, Scotland, and that's where the Roslyn Chapel is. And the Roslyn Chapel is this very strange place where supposedly the Knights Templar escaped to after their whole turmoil of them trying to find the Holy Grail. The Knights Templar, everyone knows from the Da Vinci Code, were this very powerful sect of warriors back in the Middle Ages. They were the basis for a lot of the military having to do with the Crusades. They were then turned on and persecuted. And the story goes is that a lot of them came up to Roslyn, Scotland, actually the Roslyn Valley in Scotland, right near Bonnybridge. And supposedly a lot of their secrets are buried there or buried nearby. Roslyn Chapel is at the climax of the book, Da Vinci Code. And end of the movie, and there is a certain element of the Knights Templar legend that is centered right in Roslyn, Scotland, and for some reason, Roslyn, the area around Roslyn, is where people see more UFOs than any place else on Earth. I mean, could that be just a coincidence? It doesn't seem like it, but you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but once again, it's just one of these fascinating stories that when we came upon it, we said, well, we have to put this in the book.
And didn't that area have more than just UFO sightings?
It's one of these places that's a lot like the St. Louis Valley in Colorado, where you have this kind of potpourri of paranormal activity. I mean, ghosts and men in black and just very, in, you know, even like wolfmen and strange lights at night, strange lights coming out of the mountains, people being abducted, on top of all this UFO activity. But it's also one of these places where, for instance, they say that more people win the Scottish lottery, national lottery, in this little area of Scotland than anywhere else in Scotland. You know, I mean, what's really going on there, you know? There's nothing really distinguishable about this particular, you know, part of Scotland other than all this very strange activity is going on there.
And so I guess we're starting to run low on time. The last place I wanted you to touch on real briefly is another window area, this one in Russia, the M Triangle.
This is probably my most favorite chapter in the book. The M Triangle is a place that is very close to the Ural Mountains in Russia. Kind of an isolated place. It's almost like our Rocky Mountains, but with a very less population density. It was a place that the Russian government would not allow civilians to go in for many years, the Soviet government. The Soviet Union fell. They started letting researchers go into this place. And we could probably do a whole show on this place, but some of the strange things that happened there, above and beyond seeing UFOs on a regular basis, is that, you know, people see strange balls of light in the sky day and night at this place. They see the stars going into formations overhead. They run into people who are not of this earth, who knows where they're from. The animals have no fear of humans there. The fish have no fear of humans. You walk in the streams and the ponds and the fish come right up to you and will eat out of your hand. But people also have this sense of well-being after being in this place. And they have this sense that they have this, that they've suddenly been infused with all this knowledge that they didn't have before. And I'll just quickly tell you one example of this Russian gentleman whose name is just too hard to pronounce. He was in the Russian military. He was washed out for medical reasons. He caught on as a journalist and was sent to the M Triangle to do a story once the Russian government had allowed people to go in. He was there for 2 weeks. He saw a number of strange things. He came out after 2 weeks. And this is someone who had no formal education, went back to Moscow, wrote his story. And as soon as he came out, all of a sudden he was, there's no other word to describe it. He was infused with all this knowledge of astrophysics and astronomy and physics and so on, to the point where he became so knowledgeable about all this stuff that he had no knowledge of before that within a year and a half, he was a cosmonaut. He became a Russian cosmonaut. No formal training, nothing. All he did was spend 2 weeks in the M Triangle. It's a very strange place. People call it heaven on earth. And, you know, when you read the chapter, it's almost like, what is going on there? I don't know. And we just really touched the surface of it. So many odd things go on there. But so many positive things go on there that it almost does seem like if there is a place called heaven, and the M Triangle might be just a little piece of it here on earth.
Are you familiar with the Dyatlov Pass incident?
Could you say that again, please?
Are you familiar with the Dyatlov Pass incident where the hikers were killed up in the Ural Mountains?
No, I guess I'm not, no.
Okay. I was going to ask you if it's anywhere close to where that happened.
It is near the Ural Mountains, but I think the Ural Mountains are like our Rocky Mountains, you know.
Yeah, they go quite a bit down.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, the book is called Beyond Area 51. When did this come out?
It came out in late last year, and it's still on sale at every bookstore across the country. It's published by Penguin Putnam, and they want me to mention that you can go to Barnes & Noble, any Barnes & Noble across the country, and if they're sold out, you can order it there. But, you know, this being 2014, the best place to get it would be on Amazon.com.
Right. Where can people find you on the web?
MacMaloney.com is the best place to go. We also have a radio show not in competition with yours called Mac Maloney's Military X-Files Show. It's on 7:30 to 9 o'clock every Wednesday night on KGRARadio.com. And we talk about these things and these kinds of subjects and really just everything having to do with UFOs in the military. So Mac Maloney's Military X-Files Show or MacMaloney.com.
Okay, and any other books in the works?
No UFO-related books. In fact, I'll tell you, I might have had my fill of UFO-related books, to tell you the truth. you know, I'm used to writing novels, which do take some time and research, but when I decided to do the first first book, UFOs in Wartime, the first non-fiction book I've done in a long time, I didn't realize how much work is involved. It's probably 4 or 5 times harder and takes longer to do a nonfiction book because you have to check everything than it does to do fiction. So, you know, being a writer, I'm basically lazy, so I think I'm going to just go back to fiction and stay there.
Well, that's unfortunate because this book, I haven't read your other one, but this one is excellent, and I highly recommend it to everyone out there listening. If you find any of this interesting, the book is quite pleasant to read is the thing. It's probably because, like I said, of your fiction background, it's such an easy read with so much information in it.
Well, that's what we tried to do, and you know, I'm glad that you feel that way because that means mission accomplished.
All right. Well, I thank you, Mac. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next. We're going to take you out with some Mechanism, Bring Back the Sun.